point of concern among Indian defense circles at the moment while watching Ukraine war is, can Russian military hardware meet Indian demands, or can it sustain attacks from its enemies like China or Pakistan in future? The Ukraine war has proved Russian war machinery not up to the mark or matching to NATO countries. So I think India may not leave Russia, but will certainly upgrade its defense equipment with the defense deals with the UK and other NATO countries. And UK has already promised India to share its latest technology, and we have to wait for it.
On that note, I would like to thank Mrs. Mahjur from London for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
David Lammy, a Labour Party MP, says Prime Minister Boris Johnson is scared of briefing the British Parliament on his fruitless trip to India, which shows the trip was meant to distract attention from scandals at home. Independent journalist and commentator Sunny Hundal blasts Boris Johnson for visiting India in the middle of the Ukraine war, noting that India is far more pro-Russia than many in the West actually realise. Bruce McDee, a political blogger and activist, says Johnson's justification of visiting India in a failed attempt to change the lies agenda at home was to shift India's position on Ukraine, in which he failed completely.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
A spate of deadly terror attacks has rocked Afghanistan in recent weeks, sending ripples of fear and panic across the country and challenging the rulers in Kabul barely 8 months after the botched exit of US-led allied forces. What's remarkable is the consistent pattern of these attacks, the same set of perpetrators and victims. Most of these attacks have been claimed by the Daesh terrorist group, which has managed to regain a foothold in the crisis-stricken country with the overt and covert support of foreign spy agencies.
The holy month of Ramadan was again marked by violence and bloodshed in Afghanistan, where the Daesh terrorist group has made a comeback in parallel with the Taliban's dramatic takeover. A string of explosions ripped through schools, mosques, buses and markets in major cities such as Kabul, Mazar-e-Sharif and Kunduz in recent weeks, leaving scores dead. Most of these attacks targeted members of the minority Hazara Shia community, which has a history of persecution. Daesh proudly claimed responsibility for the carnage, further destabilizing the nation that is already grappling with the worst economic and humanitarian crisis. However, what has got security analysts thinking is the ease and ferocity with which the terrorist group has been able to carry out recent strikes, which evidently points to the hand of Western spy agencies that have shared goals with Daesh now. Notably, in the months leading to the US ouster from Afghanistan, thousands of terrorists made their way into the country and were recruited by Daesh. What is also notable is these foreign terrorists infiltrated the country under the nose of US-led allied forces. There is a popular belief that Daesh and Western spy agencies are hand in glove in destabilizing the country to undermine the Taliban rule and manufacture a pretext to invade the country again.
The latest spell of violence in the crisis-hit South Asian country and the resurgence of the Daesh terrorist group has created fresh security challenges for the Taliban rulers, who continue to insist that the group has been wiped away from the country. while it's becoming increasingly clear that the terrorist group is playing the role of proxy for Americans in Afghanistan, pressure is mounting on the new rulers in Kabul to put an end to violence and ensure the safety and security of vulnerable ethnic minorities.
The country lying at the crossroads of South and Central Asia is again finding itself in the grip of foreign-backed terrorism after 20 years of foreign military occupation. Having been humiliated and thrown out of the war-ravaged country, foreign powers have now found a new ally in Daesh to execute their nefarious designs in the country. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi recently pointed to this fact by holding Western spy services responsible for violence in Afghanistan. President Raisi also called on the Taliban to get its act together and protect the lives of all Afghans, including religious minorities. There seems to be a consensus on the fact that the buck stops at the current rulers in Kabul. The responsibility of protecting the citizens of Afghanistan and eliminating all forms of terrorism lies with the Taliban. While Daesh sees the Taliban as an irreconcilable enemy that needs to be militarily defeated, the Taliban sees Daesh as an evil force that has no place in Afghanistan. It is incumbent on the Taliban to eliminate the new threat posed by Daesh and its foreign backers, and it's also important for the group to form an inclusive government, which can pave the way for peace and stability in the country.
Now to shed more light, we are joined by Mr. Mustafa Ariyayi, author at Covert Action magazine. So glad to have you again on the program, sir. Now, Afghanistan has been rocked by a string of deadly explosions in recent weeks, mostly targeting minority Hazara Shias. What do perpetrators seek from attacking schools and mosques in the holy month of Ramadan?
Right. Unfortunately, we have been witnessing a cascade of terrorist attacks for the last couple of weeks in Afghanistan. And this is part and parcel of another greater project whereby, certain forces are trying to stoke more violence in the country and thereby creating more instability in Afghanistan. And it is, of course, very suspicious that this, the timing of it, of course, one would expect that during the holy month of Ramadan, an attack like that, an inhumane attack like that, should actually never happen, but certainly not during a holy month like that, whereby unknown number of innocent civilians are being killed. And so one cannot merely call this sectarian violence anymore. There are reasonable voices that who would even plead that everything that is happening in the country or has been happening for the last two decades actually signifies something much greater than sectarian violence, namely genocide. Over and over again, we have seen how the Shiite minority in Afghanistan, but also as of recently, we have seen attacks orchestrated against Sufi groups in the country, and whereby an attack was orchestrated against a group of Sufis while they were praying or in their place of worship, which was in Dar al-Amun, which is located roughly 2 kilometers from the capital, Kabul. And that attack culminated in the death of at least 300 innocent civilians. So, and this kind of violence, unfortunately, goes back 20 years ago when Afghanistan had a Western-backed corrupt government, and in that, you know, under the reign of both Karzai and Ahmadzai, and with their entire entourage of political supporters, which included also many leaders or political leaders from different religious groups and ethnic groups, but they were unfortunately all involved in a situation where they were more preoccupied with their own personal gains rather than taking care of collective interests, that of the Afghan people.
Ms. Ariyayi, Daesh claimed responsibility for the terrorist attacks, even though Taliban officials insist that the group has already been wiped out from the country. Now, do you see a sinister game being played by foreign powers to destabilize the country?
Absolutely. I mean, it was pretty much wishful thinking by a lot of people when they saw the Americans or the Western powers leaving Afghanistan. And a lot of people were thinking, oh, this is probably the end. But I would say this is only the beginning of the end. Of course, the foreign powers, they didn't just leave Afghanistan. Of course, there was a power vacuum when they left the country and the Taliban took it over. And it was some kind of a very, almost an ideal situation where you had the United States, you know, the occupiers leaving the country, and they were indeed occupiers. But it was not that they left the country without a strategy, or they just left the country with, well, okay, we lost the war and that's it. No, they have a long-term strategy for the entire region, which includes Afghanistan, but also the broader region, Central Asia. And it's this brings us back to a historical time span where there was a great power rivalry between terroristic Russia and the great British Empire, and that was coined as the Great Game. But for many Afghans, this Great Game has never really stopped, and there are very sinister plans involved, unfortunately, because there are still many CIA officials operating in Afghanistan. And so the West certainly does have a stake in that part of the region, and Afghanistan unfortunately happens to be a part of that.
Now, many reports suggest that Daesh Takfiris have regained foothold in the war-ravaged country with the patronage of Western spy agencies to undermine Taliban government and to foment civil war. Now, what's your take on this?
Well, unfortunately, the Taliban government doesn't have that much of a support inside the country. And I think that both Daesh and Taliban, from an ideological point of view, are pretty much related to one another. They're both adhering to a very hardcore branch of Hanafi-style government, where there is no place for pluralism. And of course, the Daesh, you know, divide and rule, that is still the prevailing rule by foreign powers, and how to, in terms of how to meddle in a country that is not much of their liking. And Afghanistan is certainly, it is an epicenter of that in Central Asia, where they really try to make Afghanistan once again a safe haven for terrorism. The end goal, of course, would be the destabilization of Afghanistan and with it Central Asia. And that forms an existential threat to a lot of neighboring countries, but also regional powers like Iran, and of course, great powers like China, Russia. So yes, there are many very, very dark plans involved, unfortunately, and outside powers, they have a great stake in that. And the Taliban is a symptom of that, but you know, one could easily think of Daesh, because even there were even reports back, you know, years ago where the Afghan Defense Ministry actively took part in replacing Daesh elements from the south of Afghanistan to the north. So it was a long-standing plan already, and it comes into fruition now. And Daesh, unfortunately, they already had a hold in Afghanistan.
There you have it, Mr. Ariyai, author at Covert Action magazine from the Netherlands. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Qom seminary scholar and multimedia producer Sheikh Muzaffar Abbas cites the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, back in 2018, warning of the U.S. relocating Daesh terrorists from Iraq and Syria to Afghanistan. Hadi Nasrallah, a political analyst and writer, says the recent string of terror attacks in Afghanistan bears the hallmark of the U.S. spy agency, which is using its proxy Daesh to stoke civil war in Central Asia. Filmmaker and writer Richard Woolley states that Al-Qaeda has always been America's proxy force in the region, who together with the Daesh terrorist group carry out the amoral and devious mission of the U.S.
And that was our episode about Western efforts to woo India with attractive defense cooperation offers to push it away from Russia. and also how Daesh and foreign backers are hell-bent on destabilizing Afghanistan and stoking civil war and sectarian divide in the country. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
قُلْ مَا أَسْأَلُكُمْ عَلَيْهِ مِنْ أَجْرٍ إِلَّا مَنْ شَاءَ أَنْ يَتَّخِذَ إِلَىٰ رَبِّهِ سَبِيلًا
Say, I do not ask of you for it any payment, only that whoever wills might take to his Lord a way.
The 57th verse of Surah Al-Furqan says, قُلْ مَا أَسْأَلُكُمْ عَلَيْهِ مِنْ أَجْرٍ إِلَّا مَنْ شَاءَ أَنْ يَتَّخِذَ إِلَىٰ رَبِّهِ سَبِيلًا Say, I do not ask you a wage for it, except for him who wishes to choose a way unto his Lord. As you have been previously with us, dear listeners, in the previous episodes we discussed how the polytheists chose idols for worshipping, and the Almighty Allah told the Prophet and somehow sympathized with him that your job is just to give them glad tidings and warn them, and it is their own responsibility if they do not want to choose the right path. Now, in this verse, Almighty Allah is commanding the Prophet ﷺ to tell people that he does not ask of them any reward for this Qur'an and conveying this heavenly religion. A successful leader is the one who declares to people that he does not expect anything from them. And this is a true lesson for us. If one wants to get the rank of sincerity, he has to stop willing and desiring for any physical, positional, and verbal reward. And in this case, The Holy Prophet is telling the people that he is not asking them any reward for this Quran, save that the people may choose a way unto their Lord. The verse says, قُلْ مَا أَسْأَلُكُمْ عَلَيْهِ مِنْ أَجْرٍ. Say, I do not ask you a wage for it. The word he, the pronoun he in alayhi, is referring to my ministry. And the fact that I'm conveying this Holy Quran and this heavenly religion to you people. So I'm not asking anything for it. I'm not asking a wage for it in return. إِلَّا مَنْ شَاءَ أَنْ يَتَّخِذَ إِلَىٰ رَبِّهِ سَبِيلًا. Except for him who wishes to choose a way unto his Lord. So this implies that the only reward and compensation of the Prophet ﷺ is people's guidance that has happened intentionally and willfully in them, and not reluctantly and compulsorily. And from this aspect, this is a very interesting phrase that shows the maximum of kindness and benevolence of the Holy Prophet ﷺ towards his followers, because he counts their happiness and bliss as his reward. I mean, where else can you find that level of kindness in a leader and prophet?
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine.
In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
It is clear that guidance of the nation and ummah has got an extraordinarily spiritual reward for the Prophet sallallahu, because whoever leads people to a good deed is just like the one who does that deed himself. And that is why the Holy Prophet is so happy, and he is not asking them any reward for them being guided. Of course, there are also other possibilities about the commentary of this verse. Some say that the verse implies that the Prophet ﷺ does not want any reward from the people, except that they give some of their wealth to the poor for the sake of Allah, of course, if they will. But the first commentary that we mentioned is more near to the meaning of this verse. So, قُلْ مَا أَسْأَلُكُمْ عَلَيْهِ مِنْ أَجْرٍ. Say, I'm not asking a wage for it. And we said that the word it is referring to the Holy Quran and propagation of Islamic religion, because it speaks about not wanting reward and compensation for this call. So, this is the only reference for the pronoun that we can find, meaningfully. And then it continues, إِلَّا مَنْ شَاءَ أَنْ يَتَّخِذَ إِلَىٰ رَبِّهِ سَبِيلًا. This sentence, dear listeners, both stops the pretext of the pagans and somehow makes clear that acceptance of this divine call is easy and simple for anyone without any trouble and expenditure. And the last point regarding this verse, which is an important one, is that by looking at all these latest verses together, we realize the truthfulness of the Prophet's call. These verses testify to the truthfulness of this call and purification of his thought and program. Because false claimers do this certainly for the sake of some indirect or direct reward, but this is what the true leader, what true prophet is telling the people, that your happiness is my reward. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode of the program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always, but for me, worry ends when faith begins.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Ata, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Habib and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
And Brother Habib Zata, assalamu alaykum.
Wa alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
So, Islam and yoga. Okay, Sayyid Mohsen, if you want to, unwantedly, some people around the world, even in the Muslim communities, are practicing yoga. What's the problem? Where does the problem come from? I mean, because the feeling that your prayer, your du'as, your supplications, I mean, to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has to given to you, is not given, and then the yoga is going to replace it. Where does the problem come from? Is it with me not practicing Islam in a good way, in a perfect way, and then replacing yoga with namaz or prayer or something?
Well, I disagree with the opinion that you said, like with the supplication or the prayer that we have. We do not get that kind of spirituality, and then that's why people are going towards the yoga.
Okay.
This is not the reason, because it has become a trend in the Western world. Now, the problem is those who have the, worldview, the material worldview, they don't believe in metaphysic, okay? And they don't believe in spirituality. On the other hand, they have anxiety, stress, different problems in the society. So they're after peace, some inner peace.
But Sayyid, yoga is yoga, a spiritual action, isn't it?
I know. That's the reason why yoga has spread in the West is because it was an exercise initially.
Mm-hmm.
It was introduced as an exercise which gives you a peace. You can find inner peace. And then later when people went after it and mm-hmm. like the research has been done, obviously it has come like it's a specific traditional thing, which is a ritual in a specific, you know, religion.
Okay.
But initially, when you look at the history of it, how it spread in America, for example, in mm-hmm. the West, it was introduced as an exercise. So they introduced it as an exercise, and later, obviously, people know about the reality. So the reason was inner peace. Now, a person who is a Muslim who prays, he definitely finds some peace when he prays, when he recites Quran, when he fasts in the month of Ramadan. You know, he has that peace, but he cannot maintain it for a longer time. That's the main issue. You know, many people, they ask, like, for example, like in the month of Ramadan, we are having very spiritual, you know, mentality, but right after Ramadan, it finishes. Why? Okay. Because they cannot keep it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not the reason for the Muslims exercising yoga.
Yes.
Yoga is being exercised because of being an exercise, something new,
mm-hmm.
you know, where you do not move a lot.
Okay.
We are lazy as well. Okay. We don't want to have an exercise, said, heavy exercise.
Usually, you guys sit in exercise rather than acting and walking or jogging or something
like
that.
Some people like that. Most of people are liking that. So that is one of the reason. The one reason is like why people are exercising it mm-hmm. because of this. And in the Muslim world also, they are not basically exercising or trying to do yoga in order to have a spiritual level
mm-hmm.
or gain a spiritual level.
They have ignorance
level.
About the fact
yeah.
of the
they even
essence
don't know.
Of yoga.
They even don't think about this. Mm-hmm. They even don't have this mentality which we are talking right now.
Okay.
They even don't practice yoga with this, because when you ask general people, like, why are you doing yoga? They say it's an exercise. It's a trend in the world.
Okay.
You know, they see like people sitting on the mats and making different postures.
Yes.
So that is the main reason that they're
usually they consider as an exercise or a sports or something like that.
So we cannot say like because people are not finding their spirituality in the mm-hmm. prayers or supplications, that's why they're going towards the yoga.
Mm-hmm.
So it was introduced because it was an exercise, and people are doing some kind of exercise which has been a good trend in the world. Like it has a trend.
So what if a Muslim does, for example, yoga in the morning or something
that.
Like
I said that.
That.
If it is just the exercise, he's doing it as an exercise.
No, and reaching peace, as you said.
No.
What if the spiritual peace is achieved, Sayyid?
No, they cannot achieve even yoga.
No, they achieve it, man.
Yoga has a long way to achieve it. You know, in the definition, I can just read the definition of the yoga. Like when they reach to it, it's not like, you know, you practice it for a month and you reach to something. You have to practice for many years, mm-hmm. at least 1 year. And in Islam, obviously, we have this, like, if you do an amal, if you do have to do something, practice it for 40 days, you can reach to something, as brother was mentioning about some examples. So, you know, it's the way, like, even in the definition, they have said it, those who are the teachers of yoga or those who have started it, they say, like, when the five senses along with the mind mm-hmm. remain still and the intellect is not active, that is known as the highest state.
Mm-hmm.
Now, can you imagine someone exercising yoga for a month or two and he reaches to this state? No. You know, when we stand for the prayers, we have all thinking, all the thoughts coming into the prayers.
Mm-hmm.
We are not very much, you know, focused about the prayers. Right. So this has been practiced as an exercise. And even if they feel something out of it, you know, we always feel peace when we do exercise.
Yes.
For example, the person who is...
I feel peace when I watch, for example, football games at the end of the day. It's not,
you know,
no, is it
a person?
Peace?
A person, for example,
no,
yes,
spiritual peace.
No,
spiritual peace.
You're
no,
naming it.
No,
you're naming it spiritual peace, but that is satisfaction.
Satisfaction.
Yeah, satisfaction.
I need to. Yeah.
That's what I wanted to.
Yes,
that's what I wanted to.
That's the satisfaction that he's feeling, and this satisfaction, maybe he named it as peace, but this is not the peace that, you know, the Buddhists, they say, like their monks. What they say is as the peace which they find in the, you know, yoga.
Yes.
That is satisfaction. You know, if someone is doing exercise and he has this habit and he does not perform it for a day or two, he does not feel satisfaction in those 2 days.
A question just popped up to my mind.
Yes.
How about satisfaction in this? In the idea of Islam? Is satisfaction capable of being wretched in this world? Or is the true satisfaction in the hereafter? The true satisfaction, that spiritual peace that you're talking about.
And how are you
can
sure?
Can it be attained in this world? And like how you said, if I reach this in this world, how am I sure that it is that spiritual satisfaction? Why don't we say that's the devil and the demons playing tricks on us?
Yeah. And so how can we be sure that you guys not an otherworldly action?
What do you mean?
I mean, getting you into a kind of a spiritual perfection that will be usable for the metaphysical world. Because in the early teachings of the yoga, as I read it out these days, you know, I understood that it is very much like a religious action.
It's getting away. It gets you away from the from karma and from whatever negativity in the hereafter and whatever. They state that.
Yeah, but the modern version, you know, is very much, you know, this modernistic look at everything has changed the concept of yoga into something as daily routine fitness activity, which is very much different.
So from that's why you say it is a satisfaction, not the peace. You know, it's not the spirituality.
So what about the original form, Sayed? I mean, if somebody practiced it in the original form, which dates back to before Islam. I mean,
5,000 years before.
Yes. Something before these monotheistic religions and these actions, in the true sense of the word, gets you closer to the, I don't know.
Well, they call it the definition which definition which they get, they say yoga is a skill in action, known that which is called yoga to be separation from contact with suffering. Now, imagine a person who is practicing yoga at that time, or even at this time when you go to the Buddhist, like their
the ashes,
you know,
they call it, right?
The main part of their worships, where they worship. When you see that person is separate from the whole world, he's sitting on a corner. He's exercising yoga, which is part of his worshiping. He performs other things as well. Yes. But he never has a contact with this world.
Okay.
He does not have kids.
That's their goal.
You know, he does not have the kids. You know, this is what Islam stops us from.
Sorry, what about a person who is leading a prayer in his solitude without connecting the world?
What do you mean?
It's very much the same. I mean, for example, in your spiritual experiences, when you are alone.
That's accepted.
No, when you are alone, you know, you are
doing...
You're
alone for a couple of hours.
You're alone
for a couple of hours.
We're talking about he's totally separate from the world. You know, there are two different things. When we're talking about the world, when we talk about the Islam says, like, the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salatu wasalam, when they came, like, what was the difference between Sufism and Shiism? Sufism has the same concept, like, you need to cut off from the world.
I'tizad, that's the concept of I'tizad.
So you cut off from the world. You do your thing, you reach to your goals, your spirituality. You know, we have many examples. For example, there was a lady who was a monk. She came to Imam Zainul Abidin, alayhi salatu wasalam, and she said, "Oh, Imam, I have these, powers that I have got from what I used to exercise."
But I'm not married.
And Imam said, "Like, how you got this state?" Yeah. She said, "I never married. Yes. I never had a kid, husband. I was just praying, worshiping, and that's it." And Imam said that if this was the case, if this was the criteria of getting to higher ranks and getting these powers, then why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala made Hazrat Zahra Sayyidatun Nisa al-Alamin, the leader of all the women of the world, where she is the leader of all the women of the world. She's the mother of
life.
All these powers and more than this.
Yes.
Where she had the kids, she was taking care of the kids, she had a husband, she had a father, she was living in the society, teaching people. So Allah has put everything in the house. He had made this in the social life, that because we are the social animals. So Islam is about being the social animal, being socializing with the people.
Yes.
Not getting away from the society.
Adding to your answer, brother, at the end of the day, we stated, both of us, that there could be, you know, these talents, these, you know, benefits, these rewards. They can be wretched. The satisfaction could be wretched. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no doubting it. But who says that's the true satisfaction that you need? That's the purpose of your life.
Okay.
That's the question that remains up there. How do you know that this is the satisfaction? And I'm 100% sure that they don't have no answer except that this is what we feel. Mm-hmm. This is what we know. We have gained it through experience. Who says that your experience is right? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the creator, let's say. Let's not call him Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The creator has sent down over 140,000 prophets.
Okay.
Not one prophet I have seen has stated that you should do this kind of exercise, this kind of staying away from people and whatnot. Rather, what we see is like how my brother was stating, that you socialize, you help your brothers, you build a community, you live your life normally, like how we usually do, right? But there are some rules, there are some boundaries, there are some guidelines in this life and lifestyle. So at the end of the day, we need your evidence of proof that this is something that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants.
There are a couple of more examples if I can add. Like, you know, for example, if there is a person like who's hungry, when you give him a food, you feel satisfied.
Okay.
You feel a peace inside you. Mm-hmm. Where does this has come from?
So as a Muslim, preacher,
you know, there was an animal who was homeless. You're helping that animal. You feel satisfied. You know, there are many, many examples that when you socialize in the community, when you help people, you get more satisfaction rather than, you know, being away from the society, practicing something on your own.
If
that's
why
in Islam, that's why in Islam also, it is very much emphasized on the worshipping in a group, jama'ah. You know, al-barakah fil jama'ah. Blessing is
in the jama'ah. Of course, you have collecting yoga nowadays too. You know, they do it in a group form too, you know.
That's the, you know.
They have International Day of Yoga, you know.
If you more
that might be something wrong in the yoga teachings.
Okay.
If you ask the Orthodox, wrong. You know, those who are Orthodox.
Gurus.
Yeah. If you ask them, they will deny this thing because it's something individual. And everyone has to reach to their own level individually.
Doesn't it close the way of dialogue between, for example, Islam and Buddhism? I mean, negating the whole yoga or something? For example, if you want to talk to a Buddhist about the yoga and what are the benefits?
It's a specific ritual that they practice. For example, you know, if they come and they talk straightforward about the fasting or giving zakat, alms.
Because they do fasting too.
For example, like for alms, charity we have a specific... If they come and start with this, that is not the point of getting together. The main point is, you know, you want spirituality, we want spirituality. You want peace, you want this world to be in a form of peace. We want this world in the form of peace. So we need to talk about the, you know, kuliyat, we say, like, what is it? The major topics, not the minor things. Because, you know, when you get
universal
into
concepts.
The minor concepts and the minor things, then obviously there are the disputes.
That's right.
You know, for example, between us and Hindus, we eat meat. They worship cow.
Yes.
So how can you get, you know, united?
There's a cow in the middle. There's a cow in the middle.
Okay. Thank you, my Sayyid Mohsen.
Welcome.
Brother Habib, for your presence in the program. Viewpoints, that's all we have time for today's discussion. Okay. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Call of Islam page, also YouTube, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned. The late Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani stated a beautiful sentence. He said, "A person who does not consider a minor sin as major, verily he or she may consider a major sin as something minor." This means that if someone belittles a minor sin, he or she will be trapped in doing the major sins too. When you belittle a sin, you are belittling the God. The very great God considers the sins as major. So how can we consider the sins as minor acts?
یکی از شاگردان آیت الله صمد آقای خانساری میگفت تو درس آیت الله آقای خانساری که فوق العاده بود تو درس فقهشون.
One of the students of the late Sayyid Ahmad Khansari narrates, when the late Sayyid was teaching the jurisprudential rulings about adultery, he repeated the word adultery only once during the whole course, because he believed that even repeating such a word in a scholar's circle will be a minor sin. This is how the true men of God are even careful about their words and manner of talking. Therefore, we must not prepare the ground for committing major sins by belittling the minor sins. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en, Kalav Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri wa salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Dear brothers and sisters, welcome back to our third edition. The lecture series this year is called The Transition. And what we've started with this year is the Barzakh, our beginning or our initial stage as we transfer from this world into our final abode. Now what we'd like to talk about a little bit is the idea of the squeeze in the grave. If you look at some of the ahadith,
It seems that almost everybody gets a taste of the squeezing in the grave. But then I'm going to mention another hadith from Imam Sadiq that again gives us hope that if we're able to take care of certain things, maybe we can avoid it. Let's see. Let's look at the hadith. The first one says this, إِنَّهُ لَيْسَ مِنْ مُؤْمِنٍ إِلَّا وَلَهُ ذَمَّ. There is no believer, the first hadith, there is no believer except that this person will be crushed in the grave. To what extent? Allahu A'la. On the other side, though, we do have that hopeful hadith from the Imam where he tells us, the man was asking, he said, well, all those wonderful things, again, it was Abu Basir, if all of those wonderful things that you described take place, what about the getting squeezed in the grave? And the Imam said, Hayhat, ma ala al-mu'minina minha shay'un. Mu'mineen don't have any of that. So, the levels of iman are different, but it's something that's definitely to be there. It is definitely one of those things that's a mention. Now, there are certain things that the Ahlul Bayt have said cause this, meaning out of all of the sins, because I mean, obviously, our chance in this world is to, first of all, make tawbah. If there's something that we've done, let's make up for it. Why wait to face these things? Why have it be, as it's mentioned in some of the hadith, it's kafara. Why go into the next world with a kafara, with sins that I haven't made up for? It's better to take care of it here. But what are some of the sins, some of the problems, the issues, the spiritual diseases that the Ahlul Bayt have said, if you have these, then this is something that really needs to be, we need to be concerned about. The first one is called taking the prayer lightly. This is different than abandoning prayer. Some people just don't pray. It's just, the imam is there, inshallah, he'll save me, the love of the Ahlul Bayt. But there's other people who know, they do that, but then the prayer for them just isn't that serious. If I pray it late, if I pray it on time, it's just, it's not a biggie. I don't place importance on the prayer, which is something that we see that our ulama have warned us about. So Lady Fatima asked her father, what happens to the person who takes prayer lightly? Again, as I said, this is different from the person, the hadith, the other said, the person who just abandons prayer, that's kufr. What about the person, Ya Abata, ma liman tahawana bisalatihi min ar-rijal wan nisa. For those men and women who don't take the prayer quite as seriously as they should, what happens to those people? The Prophet explained that there were actually 15 punishment, but three of them are related to our discussion. One of them is that Allah will set an angel on this person to torture and torment the person in the grave. This is one of the ways of the person being purified. There will be an angel to deal with that person in the grave. The second one he mentions, وَيُضَيَّقُ عَلَيْهِ قَبْرُهُ. The grave will, this person will be under a lot of pressure from the grave. And the third one is that instead of the grave being light, remember we talked about the good mu'min, how the grave will be expanded, the door from heaven. This person who takes the prayer lightly will find that the grave is very dark. Another one that's mentioned, number two, are those people who don't take the rules of tahara and najasa seriously. Now, again, this doesn't mean falling into the trap of waswas, which is a sin. That's a sin. So we're not talking about going above and beyond. The Ahlul Bayt have said, consider this tahir. We consider it tahir. It's a sin to act on waswas. We're not talking about that. But there's some people who just, it's just not that important. It's clean. Who cares? The rules. And you see that sometimes. That's actually one of those things that can lead to the squeezing in the grave. The third one is actually really important. In some of the hadith, it says a third of the squeezing and the pressure in the grave comes from this third one. And that is ghibah, backbiting. I don't know how many of us remember when we read the statement of Imam Khomeini. I mean, not the statement. Many of us have probably read the 40 hadith. And there's beautiful discussions over there. One of the discussions is about the concept of ghibah. This hadith was, the first time I saw this hadith was over there, where he quotes, this is a hadith from Imam Ali. It says, اجتنب الغيبة. Avoid backbiting. Stay away from it. Don't do it. Because remember, in Islam, listening to ghibah is also a sin. So
So one time, God forbid, I'm the person who will talk about others. And of course, there are some exceptions. When is it allowed? We need to find that, like any other rule. When is it allowed for me? When is someone allowed to do ghibah? But let's say it's one of the cases where I'm not actually backbiting, but I'm listening when somebody else does it. And I don't defend the person. Because if you look in the rulings, they say that either you try and say, no, inshallah, that's not the case. But sometimes the way the person's explained, there's no way to say that that didn't happen. Then you again say something like, well, people can make mistakes, somehow defending the person that, but let's say somebody didn't do that. The imam says, he says, avoid backbiting. He says it's part of the, it's the food of the dogs of hell. Inshallah, when I go a little bit further into the actions taking on a corporal form, you'll see what that means. But in the meantime, one of those that's to really be avoided is backbiting. Another one that you'll find is very serious, and it can out or undo a lot of our good deeds, is if we are not the most pleasant of people to be around in our homes. So it might be that the story that I'm about to share is about a father. He was a father, and unfortunately, his akhlaq was not the best in the home. But it might be a son, a daughter, a sibling, people who are working closely with another group of people. And what's so interesting is sometimes you'll find that the person's oblivious to how others feel from them. Like, it's hard to even correct a person sometimes because I don't see how toxic of a person I am. There was one time when at least I know that, look, that's an area that needs to be addressed. I'm not very pleasant to be around. I'm not a pleasure to talk to. It's not easy to hang out with me. I make life hard. People walk on eggshells around me. But you'll find sometimes a person didn't even know. Now, the story that shares and the thing, and it just makes us, again, so concerned, is because the person who unfortunately had this, and we all got to learn this lesson, was one of the great companions of the Prophet. To the extent that some of the researchers said that if he stood with, if he was alive, at the time of Saqifah, he would have been one of those people who would have turned the tides. He was that kind of a strong companion. And of course, when he died, the Prophet took care of the burial rituals himself. He was walking with the, escorting the body. The Prophet didn't have the abba on or the cloak on. He didn't have shoes on. He's walking barefoot. Then not only that, he would put his hand on different areas as they're carrying the body. The Prophet's moving his hand to one side. The Prophet's moving his hand to the other side. After that, then the Prophet, the burial rituals, all these things, the Prophet over there smoothing out the grave. And then after that, his mom was so happy about it. She was like, "Ya Sa'd, haniyan lakal jannah. Just watch what the Prophet did. You're definitely, your place is in paradise." And right there, the Prophet stopped her. He said, "Umm Sa'd, don't make a rule for God. Don't say something definite's going to happen. Right now, Sa'd got that squeeze." The believers, they waited till everything ended. Then they came to the Prophet and they asked him, they said, "Well, what did we just see? We see you walking." He said, "Well, there were so many angels." He had told them 70,000 angels. Hand on the right side, hand on the left side. That was Angel Jibreel. My hand was in his hand. You did all of these things. And then after that, the grief. Then the Prophet said the sentence, "Na'am, innahu kana fi khulqihi ma ahlihi su'a." Unfortunately, he wasn't the easiest person to get along with at home. So, as I said, it could, if it can outdo somebody who was at that low. I mean, the poor guy, the reason he died was he was hit with an arrow and then finally bled out. And he died, and then he went back to meet Allah. But still, that didn't cancel out how he mistreated people. He's just mean. And some people are like that. Very good Muslim, makes salat, pays zakat, do so many good, but I'm just mean. Words are harsh. Not a pleasure to be around.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
this program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكيم.